Welcome to Mandala Talk. I'm Mandala Magazine editor Laura Miller with an interview with Craig Preston. Craig has been teaching classical Tibetan for nearly two decades. He's also a translator, currently working on a project led by Jeffrey Hopkins. In August 2012, Craig stopped by Mandala's office in Portland, Oregon to talk about translation, the importance of studying Buddhist philosophy, and the future of Buddhism in the West.
Tell me, how did you become interested in doing the translation work and teaching Tibetan? What's your background and how did you come to find yourself doing this?
Well, that's a long story, actually. It was not a direct route. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I had to learn Tibetan twice because of the route that I took.
Oh, yeah.
I started in high school. I heard about Buddhism, mostly Zen Buddhism at that point, things like Suzuki Roshi's book. And I was just interested in Buddhism in general, but I was also interested in Hindu meditation systems, and I was not distinguishing clearly between the two. Into the 70s, I was just kind of wandering around, not doing too much, and my parents were anxious for me to go to college. And I was a resident of Virginia at the time, and I heard that the University of Virginia, you could learn Tibetan there. And I had thought that I wanted to learn Tibetan. The translations that were available in those days weren't so good. So I started UVA as a undergraduate at 28. Mm-hmm. And Hopkins, his PhD program had been underway for 6 years already at that point. And I didn't really know anything about it. But I just showed up for first year Tibetan and kind of got absorbed into the graduate Buddhist studies program there. And I did coursework in that for 4 years while earning an undergraduate degree. I was the first UVA undergrad ever to major in Tibetan. You would think, well, okay, I would have done almost all the coursework for the PhD. I would just go into the doctoral program. But I didn't do that. I long felt that I wanted to be a lawyer and try cases. So I went on to law school. UVA, and then I practiced law in rural Virginia for 7 years. So it was 10 years when I wasn't actively doing new Tibetan things. And then a friend of mine, Bill McGee, who was a doctoral student in Jeffrey's program, had started, he'd finished all his coursework, and while he was writing his dissertation, he was a translator at Namgyel Monastery in Ithaca. And my wife and I were looking for a northern college town since our kids were ready for high school at that point. So we moved up to Ithaca, and I just kind of started teaching Tibetan immediately. Like, literally, I rolled into town and went to school with Bill, and now I'm teaching Tibetan. But I had to relearn it, after 10 years out. And Joe Wilson had just published his How to Translate Buddhism from Tibetan. And I was using that as sort of my analytic grid. And I was rereading Hopkins' translations. I had done a series of dual language translations using Jeffrey's English and then the original Tibetan. Even then, I was starting to assemble books, but I never thought of myself as a writer. And wow, that was like 15 years ago. And I've just been teaching Tibetan ever since.
Where were you teaching in Ithaca? Who did you start teaching, like, when you arrived in town?
Well, I started at Namgyel Monastery. Okay. They had started a Institute of Buddhist Studies, okay, kind of on the UVA model. And there was a lot of interest in Ithaca about things Tibetan. And there had been a center for kind of eclectic studies that a lot of the folks in Ithaca had been going to for years. In fact, that was one of the places that the Dalai Lama went on his first tour, mm-hmm, to America. So I started teaching there, and then since they offered only really first year, then I was teaching upper-level students at home. And that just has gone on and on.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then when you moved to Buffalo, was that because of this grant that...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I went where the money was.
Okay, and so tell me a little bit. I mean, it seemed like that... tell me a little bit about it, because your law background all
yes,
of a sudden becomes
exactly
relevant.
Yes,
again.
Exactly. Rebecca French is an amazing scholar. She has a doctorate from Yale in legal anthropology. This was not an area that I was even aware of. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to get a JD degree, and she published a very well-known book called The Golden Yoke about Tibetan legal systems. And she did her field work in Dharamsala for, she was there 5 years at least, working with one of the last living magistrates prior to the Chinese takeover in 59. She wanted me to work with her, both because I was I had much more experience with classical Tibetan, and I'd focused more on the religious side. And she wanted colleagues. You know, we all want colleagues. So yeah. She figured she could get me to town, and we could have a good time translating the Tibetan codes. And indeed, we did. I had a number of graduate students when I was in Buffalo. They have a very rich language program, a lot of Chinese being studied. The majority of the students that I had in my Tibetan class had already had a couple of years of Chinese, and some of them had already been in Beijing for a year studying there. So it was a very enthusiastic place for language study. Mm-hmm. But, you know, education took a big hit a couple of years ago, and grants dried up and money went away, and, you know, everybody was broke at that point. And just fortunately, that's when Hopkins was able to put together a grant to have his old graduate students working on translating Zhang Yimsheba's textbooks. So I started doing that. That happened actually last, it began at the beginning of last summer. I had been asked to come teach at Maitrepa last summer, and that was already been set up. When Jeffrey had gotten the funding together for this. So I was just partially working on it last summer, but after summer school ended here, I went back to Buffalo because I really didn't, I was thinking about doing the work, not moving around. I'd always had to be somewhere because I was teaching. But this past academic year, haven't taught at all, and just worked on this translation project. So it was kind of fun to come back here again this summer and sort of get out of my office and teach some again. So I enjoyed doing that for the summer months.
Tell me more about this Hopkins project. What are the Zhang Yimsheba texts, and why should we care?
here's why we should care. There are many reasons why we should care. First off, knowledge is good. Right? Academic scholarship is good about anything. Study anything you want. Okay? Now, as we're coming to understand Tibetan Buddhism, we're very new to it. It's really only 50 years that people have been translating Tibetan texts. Essentially, almost nothing's been translated. You know, I make up figures, but 0.01%, I mean, just a tiny, tiny amount. So It's an exciting time to be a translator because all the good stuff is still there, right? You don't have to do very obscure things. Now, you know, there are many orders of Tibetan Buddhism, Gagyu, Sakya, Geluk, Nyingma, and I have studied almost exclusively Geluk, not for any partisan reasons. That's just the opportunities that have been open to me. Tsongkhapa was 1357 to 1419, and by the time he died, he'd founded three major monastic universities, Sera, Drebung, and Ganden. And over time, each of those had multiple colleges inside them, and they had textbook writers that wrote the college-level texts on Tsongkhapa's works and Gelsap and Kedrup, and then the major works of India. So this is the real hardcore college high scholastic writing. Now, Zhang Yimsheba is one of the three main scholastic authors, the textbook authors, along with Panchen Sonam Drakpa and Jetsunba. And it all should be translated. Right? Now, it just, the way it's turned out that Jeffrey, you know, call it karma or call it coincidence, but you meet some lamas and you make some connections and you just end up going down, you know, particular roads. Not because you chose it, but just more because the opportunity was there. Jeffrey first studied with a Gomong Geshe, Geshe Wangyal, and was introduced to Zhang Yimsheba's text then. This was 40 years ago. And Zhang Yimsheba wrote, you know, I don't mean to privilege him over the others. It's just that he's the one that I'm working on. He certainly wrote extensively. He wrote a huge tenets book that Ngawang Belden, a Mongolian author, annotated extensively. It's just Jeffrey's research interest, and we as his graduate students get to be in his slipstream behind him, and opportunities present themselves. You know, I bet it's the same if we were, like, doing neurobiology.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was working for so-and-so, a doctor, and he was interested in this, so I just joined his lab and kept on going with it. The opportunities that have presented themselves to me through being a student have been so extraordinarily interesting. That I'm just delighted to be able to do this at this stage. There are not that many people who are funded to be translators, and it's just great to be working with Jeffrey again. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. It seems like it's a fairly small community of people working, translating Tibetan to English. Are you kind of in groups, you know, groups over here who know each other and then other people working on other things, or how does that work?
Well, they're about, I'm going to make up a number. There may be 100.
Yeah.
So if I'm saying 100, there are probably 150 people translating into Western languages. And of those, there may be, 100 that are doing works that are getting published. You know, there's the first generation, like Hopkins and Thurman and Alex Burson, who are sort of reaching the end of their career. And then their students have produced lots of work. And I, as Jeffrey's students, I'm 61, so I'm sort of moving towards the end of my productive time. In academic translation, there people didn't work with groups particularly, because you were at a college, you did your research interest, you published what you were interested in, and you maintained your connections with people that you went to graduate school with and know, certainly. But it's unusual to get collective funding. So it was very unusual for Jeffrey to come through with the funding to fund, there are 11 of us now working, some full-time, some partially time. I mean, this is a big project.
Wow, yeah.
And that's pretty unusual.
How big is the project? How much are you trying to translate?
Well, the announced goal is all of Zhang Yimsheba's textbooks. We will not complete that in our lifetime. There's more to do than that. Than we'll be able to do.
I mean, kind of what is a textbook? I mean, just give us like the equivalency of...
Now, let's say...
Let me get a picture in my head of how many pages we're talking.
Oh, well, these are enormous. These are 1,000 pages. Yeah. Let's say you're in a geishe program. You're studying to be a geishe. And the main text that you're going to study are the Indian texts, the five principal Indian texts. And you're going to study those through the interpretive window of Tsongkhapa and his direct disciples, Kedrup, Gilsap, the first Dalai Lama. And then at your college level, your college will have its own set of textbooks exploring nuanced points within that. And then you will debate with your own students, but also against other colleges. George Dreyfus has written a wonderful book on Tibetan education, The Sounds of Two Hands Clapping, that is a great source for what it's like being in a geishe program. But here's an example. Chandrakirti wrote a book, Umalajupa, the supplement to Nagarjuna's treatise. And he probably wrote that in around the 6th century in India. And it was translated into Tibet sometime after the year 1000 and became the main focus of Majjhimaka studies for Tibetans. And all of the, all of the major figures in Tibetan scholastic history have written commentaries on it. And Tsongkhapa wrote one. Gompo Rapsa, Illumination of the Thought. Now, the way that's studied is, in general, each college then will have two textbooks on that book. they'll have a book in the genre called Jitun, a general meaning commentary, which is what we think of as a long narrative discussion of the text, in which the author discusses the meaning. Then there's a second genre of text called Taja, decisive analysis, or we would say debate books, which rely on the general meaning commentary, but present lots of debates about points of interpretive disagreement. Now, what I'm doing, I'm part of a group of five that are translating Zhang Yimshaba's Taja on Tsongkhapa's Umagompa Rabsel, Illumination of the Thought. So this is the college-level debate text that's used to study Tsongkhapa's on Chandrakirti. It's a big book. It's, you know, 1,000 pages or so. One of my colleagues, and it's based on the 10 grounds, the 10, it's organized according to the 10 Bodhisattva grounds. Jules Levinson, my old classmate, has been tasked with chapters 1 through 5. So he's got about 300 pages to translate. Two of Jeffrey's graduate students did their doctoral dissertations on parts of the sixth chapter. Guy Newlin did the Two Truths section, Derek Mars did the valid cognition section. Thankfully, the hardest section of the chapter Jeffrey himself is doing on commonly appearing subjects and teldok, opposite of consequences. And then I have to do everything else in the sixth chapter. So I've got about 300 pages to do also, doing everything that everyone else hasn't done. Now, we're a group, for sure, but we all work on our translations individually. And we were all trained by Jeffrey, so we do it his way. And then we meet with him through Skype, through the magic of Skype, to go over our translations with him. So in a way, it's kind of like being back at graduate school, that we do our work and then we meet with Jeffrey, but instead of going over to his office, we just ring him up on Skype, and he's available to us pretty much all the time. One of the side projects I'm working on for him right now is our dictionary project. We started a dictionary years ago back at UVA, and it's gone through a number of iterations. And I'm taking it from an Excel spreadsheet, which has become unwieldy, with like 18,000 lines, to an actual an Access database, so that we can then place it on the net, so anybody can access it. And Jeffrey can still edit it and update it. So we're kind of entering into, you know, a more technologically suited way. So I'll probably work on that for two more weeks in August, and then I'll go back to translation in September.
So I'm curious, how do you do, different translators work in different ways. What's your technique for, you know, you have the text and then you have to turn it into English. How do you approach that?
Yeah, well, first off, I don't think I'm very good, so I'm surprised that I even have this job. But, you know, I've been doing it 30 years, so I'm not half bad at this point. And there's been a big change this past year, because it's been my job, 40 hours a week, just translating, week after week after week. I've really noticed an increase in my ability in this year. I really feel like I've taken it up a notch. You know, if I go to the gym every day, I'll be a little bit better, but I won't be that much physically better because of my age. But translating is improving quite a bit. So at this point, what I do is just I translate each sentence. I read a sentence, and maybe I'll read it over five times, and then I'll just translate the sentence. Then I'll move to the next sentence, and then I'll just translate it. I force myself with every sentence to come down with a completed English sentence. You know, and some days I'll do a lot of sentences, some days I won't do that many. The text is It's very much like legal analysis, and that legal analysis proceeds through precedent and through citing authority. So too, Buddhist analysis proceeds by citing authority. The formative members of the of the tradition, Indian texts, Tibetan texts. So there's a lot of citation of authority. Now, the way Tibetans do this, when they quote something, they generally don't give the whole quote. They'll say, and Shantarakshita's Umagen, ornament for the middle, says, from, and then a few syllables, to, and then a few syllables. So I won't know whether that's a sentence or five sentences or whatever. So I have to go look for that source material, which is pretty easy to do now. A lot of this material is all available, at least the Indian material, is available through like the Asian Classics Input Project, where I can just go in and do string searches for the characters. I love Unicode. I can search in Tibetan now, so. So what would have been, what could have been days of going over to the library and taking books out and searching through the books trying to find a quotation, now I can just run text strings and find it sometimes within 5 minutes. But sometimes what I find is that Jangim Sheba has quoted maybe 5 pages of text, so now I have a lot more to translate. But that's the way we do it. Our house style is to fully translate all of the quoted materials.
And then does Jeffrey review your
work? Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. We are not operating on our own at all.
Do you understand what you're translating? I mean, do you have a...
Well, that's a relative question. Right. perhaps you might say, how much do I understand? Sometimes I can tell what's going on and I can clearly understand what the controversy is. Other times I can clearly read Jangim Sheba's sentence, but I have no idea why he's talking about this now. So I'm definitely doing a first draft at this point. I probably have 6 months more of getting a first draft of all my material done. And then I'll need to read through the material with Geshe's. Not from the point of view of improving my English, but from the point of view of making sure that I understand the underlying philosophic issues. And that will be a big project. It's hard for me to imagine how long that will take. That could take maybe a year or so doing that. And as I'm fully informed about the philosophic content, that will allow me to get the translation more precise and more on point. And at that point, that's when I get to bring it to Jeffrey. He is my safety net, shall we say. It's just an extraordinary privilege to be able to read this stuff with him.
And so where do you find your Geshe's?
Well, you know, we know the Geshe's that are in America. For instance, I was in Ithaca for a long time, and they're Geshe's who would come to Namgyel and teach that I made friends with. It's fun knowing Geshe's that are younger than you are. When I first started doing this, I was, you know, a little more than a kid, and the Geshe's were esteemed senior, shall we say, aged Geshe's that were very intimidating. But now I've got a Geshe who's 10 years younger than me. You know, my knowledge can't meet theirs at all, obviously, but it's much more comfortable working with them. And it's like everything else. You find some that you just like working with, and some will live with me for weeks or months at a time, and we'll work on stuff. It's a lot of fun.
It seems in general that things with technology and just everyone kind of this project of Tibet and, you know, Buddhism coming to the United States and the West, it's getting a little bit easier in many ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Skype helps, all the computer technology. Hey, when I started doing translation, I was typing out translation on a manual typewriter.
Yeah, can't imagine.
Yeah, a lot of whiteout.
So could you tell me a little bit, I imagine you know about some of the other big translation projects going on, or what you know about them?
And... Well, nothing is like the simple answer. I mean, in a way, translators, it's lonely work. We sit in our rooms. For years at a time, and we don't communicate with each other as much as we would like to, so you would think, oh, I would know what other groups are doing, but I don't.
That makes sense in a certain way. You know, it is lonely work. I suppose that's why it's nice to have the classroom, so let's talk a little bit more about teaching in the classroom.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you were just teaching downstairs at Maitripa.
Yes, yes.
So what's that? What's that about? Tell me about that work.
Okay. What I do is offer all of first year classical Tibetan in a very intensive 6 weeks, followed by 2 weeks of advanced reading on some genre studies. And basically, I teach Tibetan the way I was taught at UVA. It's a very much of a structural approach to Tibetan to understand how the grammar is operating within Tibetan sentences. And although the class is open to anyone, interested students, continuing education students, a year of Tibetan is required by Maitripa. But I aim the class for students that are either in graduate school or thinking of entering a doctoral program. So I also talk a good bit about academic methodology and the ranges of approaches to translation equivalents and how to integrate commentary with translation and topics of issue for people who are going to become academic translators.
It just from my observer point of view, it seems like there's some interesting maybe differences of approach or, you know, issues that come up from, say, a student who's more of a practitioner that wants to learn some Tibetan so that they can chant along and the pujas, or the academic side.
Absolutely.
How do you reconcile these things, or what comes up in the class?
I don't reconcile them.
Well, talk about the tensions, though.
Well, I'm a very hard teacher. It's an enormous amount of material.
Yeah.
It's 16 hours a week of classes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a couple hours of homework every night. It's hard. It's just hard, and there's an enormous amount of it. A year of graduate school Tibetan is an enormous amount. Now, I don't take a year of graduate school organic chemistry in the summer. I mean, good Lord, that would be that'd be scary, you know? Now, see, it's an interesting thing. The economics of education is an interesting thing. When I wandered into UVA, they had 4 years of required Tibetan. It was required. Everybody had to take it, right? It was funded. It was just part of the program. It was the cornerstone of the program. Well, now, because of budgetary constraints, many of the graduate programs in offering doctoral degrees in Buddhist studies in America don't offer much Tibetan. They want their students to come in already with a good reading competency. Jose Cabazon, I hear, his wonderful program down at Santa Barbara, he has maybe 100 applications a year and he admits one student. And it's largely based on their ability to be competent enough in the language to begin doing research. So where are you going to learn the Tibetan? Now, there are places in Asia, in India and Nepal, where you can learn the language, but they tend to be very traditional. And it's not the sorts of things that academic institutions expect you to do. I think it's nice. Now, I'm not speaking for Maitripa. I'm just giving what my opinion seems to be here. But it's nice that they have an open-door policy for the summer program. On the one hand, a year of Tibetan, classical Tibetan, is required for their master's students, and they can get it with me in the summer. But they also let the class and students who are not taking it for credit, who just want to be there. Well, that's okay. That makes sense, because there, you know, there are not that many places in North America where you can get a year of Tibetan in the summer. But it's more work than a lot of people want. And if you're not taking it for credit, that's fine. You know, you don't keep up. But I don't slow down, right? I'm really aiming it for those people who are either in graduate school or going to, trying to get into a doctoral program, in effect, because they will become professional researchers and professional translators.
What all this makes me think, or what one of the ideas I'm having right now, is that given our current economic situation, how universities are, the funding is just falling apart for them. It seems like this could really have an impact on the future of, you know, translating Tibetan, you know, Buddhist studies in general, or what's your opinion? I mean, the universities seem to be a little bit in crisis right now.
Yeah. Yeah. How, that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
When I started taking Tibetan, this was the fall of 78. His Holiness the 16th Karmapa had been to the United States. The Dalai Lama had not yet been to the United States. There were no celebrity Buddhists. There was no Buddhism on Peter magazine. It was a very much of a niche thing. Now, Tibetan Buddhism is everywhere. So that's changed extraordinarily much. They're for the 7 or 8 doctoral programs. They'll let in 1 or 2 students a year. And maybe that's enough. You know, there's one of the tensions between a Dharma center, which tends to be inclusive, and graduate schools, which are exclusive and meritocracies. It's easy to take classes at a Dharma center. At a graduate school, you're in competition with everyone else. So the modality is really quite different. But I'm happy to teach students who probably will not become translators, certainly will not go off to graduate school. They want to understand what they're studying better. Perhaps they want to do their sadhanas in Tibetan. 6 weeks, you can get a lot of Tibetan that way.
Maybe I'll be in your class next year.
Yeah. You know, it's there's always a lost opportunity cost for doing things. The goal is to get technical Buddhism into English, and I wonder with many people, they would probably be better served if they were just learning those translations in a really systematic, rigorous way.
Okay, here's something that I'm struggling with or trying to figure out. And we, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama encourages students to study the Nalanda masters.
Yes.
You know, practitioners.
Yes.
And as an editor at a magazine that's supposed to be, you know, serving this community, I'm like, well, how do I help people study the Nalanda masters? You know,
study them yourself. Become educated yourself and become familiar with what the issues are. Read deeply of it. Take classes.
Yeah.
Give yourself the education you would have had in graduate school. I'm setting the bar very high, but that's what you need to do. You know, if you were editor of a journal of microbiology, it wouldn't be enough to be a journalism major. You know, you'd have to understand the technical side of things to see what the issues are and what are the delivery systems that are available in the West. So I would encourage you to study as deeply as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think the advantage of that? I mean, I have maybe an answer for myself, but what's the advantage of a practitioner, a Western Buddhist practitioner, actually going and reading some of these, you know, the text from, you know, in those ancient Indian philosophers.
Yeah.
What's the advantage there? Why would he, why do you think he would suggest that?
Yeah, that's, well, let me not, don't put me in the position of imagining why he would suggest
right.
to it.
Okay.
But let's look at the historical situation.
Yeah.
Okay, where did Buddhism come from? India. Who got it? The Tibetans. It wasn't Tibetan, it came from somewhere else. So Tibetan Buddhist culture looks to India as the source of Buddhism and the source of inspiration. Well, we're in kind of a funny position. We don't look to India for a source of inspiration. We think real Buddhism comes from Tibet. So we're kind of doing a different thing than they're doing. Now, the philosophic origins, how to say this? What you think affects how you behave, right? I mean, it kind of comes down to that. You know, the purpose of study is to change your mind so that it will change your behavior. Now, it's really hard to change even the most superficial habit. Changing our most deeply ingrained cognitive habits is even harder to, and we have to bring to bear all of our mental and physical abilities to do it. But we in the West think a lot. We think about a lot of sophisticated things, and we filter through a lot of conflicting data and come to conclusions, and to some extent, we're maximizers of our own self-interest, and we act on that. The issues, I mean, there are many issues that, that's impacting here? What is one culture's experience with another culture's religion? George Dreyfus, who I think is a great writer, again, for anyone who's been involved with Tibetan Buddhism, particularly who's interested in studying in Tibetan Buddhism, I really recommend Dreyfus's The Sounds of Two Hands Clapping. Mm-hmm. One of the points he makes is that there are many levels. When we encounter Tibetan Buddhism, there may be six levels. There are three levels, perhaps, that came from India, the Hinayana level, the basic Mahayana non-tantric Buddhism, and then the Mahayana tantric Buddhism. But there are at least three levels of indigenous Tibetan culture that are all mixed in with it. Tibetan folk religion, the way that tantra was used to increase power and status, just culturally, and the nameless religion of what folk people think. Mm-hmm. Now, how much Tibetan culture is important to us as American practitioners is kind of an open question. Maybe not at all. Maybe a lot on a transition phase. There are enormous cultural differences between the West and Tibet. Tibet never developed a democratic culture. It was a theocracy. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, Tibet's fascinating. I love studying Tibet. But how much Tibetan culture undoubtedly shaped and strengthened Tibetan Buddhism. But what happens in America is much more of an open question, I think. And I think in general, because I have a graduate school modality. So I think learning things is a good idea. Learning comprehensively is a good idea. Learning the progression of Buddhist philosophy from India into Tibet in a comprehensive way is a good idea. I even think that learning Tibetan political history and to see the way in which political concerns shape doctrinal disputes. Because, alas, Asian history in general is not part of our intellectual heritage. I never learned about it in school.
Definitely, yeah.
Tibetan, Mongolian history, Chinese history, all of this shaped it. So that the Tibetans that we encounter these days, who are the data, the actual Tibetan Buddhism, are shaped by lots of concerns. Some of which are relevant to us. Some of us are simply not relevant to us at all. I'm a teacher. Learning things is good. You should learn it because it's cool. You know, that's what I think. It's fascinating. Buddhism's not a religion of belief. I believe in Buddha. Well, so what?
Yeah.
You know, that's not really the way the religion works. Well, I want to meditate. That's good. You know, develop compassion. Splendid idea. I think that's excellent. But to come to change your mind about the way you think phenomenon exists and really start undercutting the most deeply held habituations, that requires a considerable mental effort, and a large part of that effort can be intellectual, can be study. Now, this is just my inclination. Mm. Lots of other people approach it from other ways. This is why Dharma centers are more community centers than study centers generally, because a lot of people want that community and they want some ritual, and you know, that's very important for a lot of people. Fewer people are interested in studying philosophy systematically, mm-hmm. but I'm a specialist, you know. So yeah. There you go.
And do you have any desire to speculate on what the future looks like of, you know, Tibetan Buddhism in America or in the West?
Oh, I wish I knew. And it is something I think about. We see Buddhism has transformed cultures everywhere it's gone. Mm-hmm. What will happen in America? I'm curious. I don't normally wish I could go into the time machine and look ahead 200 years and see what it's like. Would I even recognize it? I do think that you're not going to have Buddhism in America without meditation. That's an easy call. But I think you're also going to need a debate tradition in America. It's not for everybody, but it's an important component. So I think that there'll be an evolution in that area, I hope. You know, it's what Americans will be interested in. The original Panditas who came to Tibet were Indian and acted Indian and created Indian-like scenes. But it became Tibetan within a few generations and became, you know, a deeply nationalistically Tibetan experience. So how will that happen in America?
Yeah, and how will it be different than what happens in Australia or what happens in France or what happens in
Mexico? Oh, you know, I haven't even thought about that. that's a fascinating topic, too. See, because you're right in the midst of an international organization,
right,
where you are all thinking globally and you're thinking about what's going on in different enclaves. I never think about that. Not because I'm not through disinterest. I'm just, you know, I'm kind of busy doing something else. Diagramming Tibetan sentences, you know.
Right, because, you know, we have the center in Singapore is incredibly active, and Taiwan's a big deal, and Malaysia, and then Australia, and then Europe. I mean, so it's, there are differences. I mean, I've seen some differences culturally.
Oh, sure there are.
But yet I'm still, like, kind of, it's going to be interesting to see how it goes, because as each country, as each region kind of develops.
Yeah. Globalization of everything, culture, religion. I mean, the Buddhism that I studied from Tibet was from a medieval theocracy, unconnected to the outside world. You know, I mean, you could say, I say this with affection, but, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around for 1,000 years thinking and meditating and writing fantastic books. We live in a different world now. What I would like to see, it's easy for me to say this, everything needs to be translated. All of the Indian texts that came from India into Tibet need to be translated, and so much of the Tibetan stuff needs to be translated. That could take hundreds of years because there's not really much money in it, so there are not that many people are going to become translators. It's very hard to make a living this way. Mm-hmm. For years, when I was teaching Tibetan, for the most part, I wasn't actually making my living that way. I did computer networking and other computer stuff for people after I was practicing law. You know, we'll just have to see how it plays out. I'm always happy to teach younger students who will have 30 or 40 years ahead of them. I really don't care what direction they go off into and what they end up translating and what their affiliations are. I just want to give them the basic understanding to find their way through Tibetan sentences. So whatever they do, they can do accurately and helpfully. So that's what I like doing. Yeah, there's one other point that I wanted to mention. A few years ago, it may have been 10 years ago now, time just kind of blows by.
Who's counting?
But the FPMT invited me to Taos, and I taught four of your geishas.
Mm.
And that was, in some ways, the best time of my entire life. I mean, I can't speak of it high enough. Mm. It was so amazingly weird. It was like going through the looking glass, and everything was backwards. Okay, rather than a bunch of students and a geisha, there was me and four geishas, right? Uh-huh. And it was a classroom, and there was a complete whiteboard, but at the end of the day, the whiteboard had English all over it rather than Tibetan over it. Because what I was doing was teaching the geishas the English for the technical topics. They knew cold. I mean, they knew the stuff so much better than I did. But it was not the technical topics that were typically taught in Dharma centers at that time.
Yeah.
But as you move sort of beyond Lamrim into the more technical topics, it's hard to teach that in English. And how do you go about teaching it in English? And that's what Hopkins built his program around at UVA. So, I mean, I don't know this stuff well, but for an American, I do. Yeah. You know, so it was fantastic teaching these geishas the most technical topics that I could go to.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, I mean, I say this you know, I'm using male vocabulary, they're geishas, they're all killers. They could all wipe up the floor with me or each other. And it was the one time in my life where I got to experience what it must be like being with students, all of whom are going to be geishas. It was just a wonderful time. In fact, my book, my second language book, came out of that program. One of the things that they asked me, and I think it was Massimo, asked me to teach some tenets. They wanted to be able to work with the vocabulary of doing tenets in English. So I saw that Jay Tsumba, who's one of the main textbook writers for Sarah J. College, wrote a very short tenets book. That would give us the opportunity to introduce all the vocabulary and talk about the issues of teaching Americans tenets. So we read that together. It was just a wonderful time. And I got to thinking that winter, well, this would be a good language book for language students, because Hopkins always emphasized tenets to learn the material. So my second How to Read Classical Tibetan book is built around Jay Tsunba's tenets book that I studied with those four geishas. So it's like you're in a hall of mirrors going back and forth between cultures and what different folks got out of it. It was just a wonderful time. I would have a class full of geishas any day of the week. I would love that. You know, in the same way that I want to teach Americans to be able to translate Tibetan so they can work more closely with geishas, so they can collectively produce translation works. I want geishas in America teaching more technical topics, because I think it's good for Americans to learn the stuff, the more hardcore stuff. So I would love to do that again. It was just great. They were just wonderful. Oh, those were hard guys, man. It was just great. So thank you, Massimo, and everyone who was, got that going. That was just great.
Thanks for listening to Mandala Talk. We send a big thank you out to today's guest, Craig Preston. Mandala Talk is produced by Mandala Magazine, which can be found online at mandalamagazine.org. We're a publication of the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, or FPMT. If you like what you've heard, consider becoming a friend of FPMT, which supports this podcast. Learn more by visiting fpmt.org/friends. I'm your host, Laura Miller. May you have a great day.